complies with the terms of the letter of credit, it must pay within 3 days in the full amount of the claim up to the limit of the letter of credit. That's the way Article 5 is written now, whereas a bond is entirely different, as a cash deposit is, which is held by the state agency. If the letter of credit must first be reviewed by the agency or the court in some cases and approved, there's still no requirement that this prorating language be included or that would be appropriate in view of Article 5. We just feel that there's too many questions in this bill that must be addressed because the public, the beneficiaries on these bonds and cash deposits, will ultimately be harmed. It's our opinion that administrative rules will not work either in some cases. They're different for each statute. There's no direction in this bill to the particular state agencies that they must issue administrative rules to comply with the current law. And not every statute in addressed by this bill has a state agency involved. Some are court bonds, for example. We feel that there's just too much involved in a bill of this size to warrant its passage in its present form. The second major area of concern for the debtor-creditor section has to do with claims. Many existing statutes require claims investigation and determination. Banks are simply not set up for that. Many bonding companies, for example, have whole claims departments set up. Why is that? Well, we think that the bank, as I explained before, the bank must pay under a letter of credit upon presentation of certain documentation, whatever the letter of credit indicates it needs to. The bank does not have any discretion. If its customer has a defense to the claim, as bonding companies' customers, principals, do often, claims are not always valid, the bank must pay anyway, irrespective of the defense. For example, a broker-dealer license under Oregon securities laws, 59-175, the bond or letter of credit would be conditioned on violation of the Oregon securities laws, including, for example, a false registration statement. Well, how would a claim under a statute like that appear in a letter of credit?
David,
we don't know.
We've got a session at 10 o'clock. We've got a lot of bills.
You've got
a lot of time to refute the testimony of the previous witness. You've exceeded the proponent's time already, as a matter of fact. And so why don't you summarize for us and then let us know whether or not you've got amendments which you're proposing for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very briefly, there are three primary areas of concern that the debtor-creditor section has with the bill. Multiple claim situations, claims investigation, that letter of credit will simply not allow the bank to do, and in some cases, bonds accumulate year to year. As Mr. Bronner has testified, these letters of credit will generally be issued for a year. They will be renewed probably in some cases, or a new letter of credit will be issued, but a bond may accumulate year to year. We do not have specific amendments to propose. We felt that was up to the proponent of the bill. Even though we do have a specific listing of approximately 48 sections that we have concerns with.
Okay, David, I believe that there were some Senate amendments that the proponents at least had a hand in drafting.
Yes.
And
those were not with respect to ours, Mr. Chair.
Well, it appears to me that the first hearing was back in March, so you've had a lot of time to work on this if you really wanted amendments to the bill. Am I incorrect about that?
You are correct, Mr. Chair. It's partially due to the problems with the bar process itself and in terms of having to approve what our committee does. Our committee did not, in fact, get wind of the bill until after the first public hearing in March, and then we set about to review it and determine what our position should be. It is a comprehensive bill. It's over 75 pages long, and it affects approximately 119 sections.
Okay, well, now wait. What are you suggesting that we do?
Well, our original position was that this type of issue is something that's too complex to review during the term. We suggested that an interim committee be appointed to study each one of these sections in proper detail and come back next session and determine where a letter of credit will work, and in those situations does the statute need to be amended, and if so, amend it appropriately. At this point, we would be satisfied with the deletion of these 48 sections, even though we still have some question about the remaining 48 without statutory amendments, but we're less concerned about those than we are about these.
Okay, thank you. Question by committee members? Okay, thank you, David.
Thank you.
Could I have a representative from the credit union come and respond
Certainly.
To my question?
Certainly. Give his name.
Steve Rodeman.
Steve Rodeman. Are you here? Steve, could you tell us, identify yourself for our record, please,
sure.
And then please tell us whether or not, to your knowledge, credit unions issue a letter of credit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Rodeman with the staff attorney with the Credit Union League. Anyone can issue a letter of credit, and credit unions are entitled to issue them as well. As a matter of course, or as a practice, we don't. Maybe once in a great while we'll have like a subcontractor on a state job needs to have some kind of a guarantee, and then we'll have that credit union go to its attorney and draft up a special letter of credit for that transaction. But as a great general rule, we do not issue them. Nothing says we can't, we just don't.
Well, have you reviewed this legislation, and do you feel like you would want to be included in this? Or have you, no one's come forth, so I'm assuming you're not interested.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Stein, we've reviewed it. It does include us, or
does.
As I say, anybody can issue these letters of credit. So it has nothing to do with who can issue them. It's just when they're effective and when they aren't. So we reviewed it, and we know about it.
What is the meaning of, excuse me, another question?
Go ahead.
There was a reason, I presume, for adding a new section in the definitions on what a commercial bank is, which excludes credit unions. Is there some particular reason for that?
I wouldn't know. I was just checking the Uniform Commercial Code on issuers of letters of credit, and it just basically says it's a bank or anyone else who can issue credit, and we certainly fit that definition.
Okay. If you're not concerned, I'm not concerned. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Further discussion? Further questions?
Widmer. Session?
Widmer?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I would move... Senate Bill 666 says engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, the motion is to send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Please call the roll.
Lieutenant Barnes.
Aye.
Cato. Oakley.
Aye.
Stein.
Aye.
Walden.
Aye.
Tyson. Mr. Chair.
Aye. Motion passes. Barnes, would you feel comfortable in carrying the number? Okay. We'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 382. Members, this deals with line of credit, not to be confused with letters of credit. Steve Statham?
Statham.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Steve Statham. I'm an attorney with Ader, Wynn, Hewitt, Dodson, and Skerritt in Portland. And I'm also a member of the Legislative Committee of the Real Estate and Land Use Section of the Oregon State Bar. I'm appearing before the committee on behalf of the Real Estate and Land Use Section in support of Senate Bill 382. The bill contains certain law improvement amendments to the Line of Credit Mortgage Statute, ORS 86.155. The Line of Credit Mortgage Statute was originally enacted in 1987. The chief purpose of the statute is to permit advances under a line of credit to retain the priority of the original recorded mortgage or trust deed. As the use of line of credit mortgages has increased in the last 3 years, certain issues have arisen that are not specifically addressed by the statute. Accordingly, the following law improvement amendments are being proposed. First, under the existing statute, the term line of credit mortgage has created some confusion or potential confusion where trust deeds are the form of security instrument. Under the proposed bill, the term line of credit mortgage is changed to line of credit instrument, and the term mortgage holder is changed to lien holder. Also, the term credit agreement is specifically defined. Second, one of the original purposes of ORS 86-155 was to accommodate the increased use of personal lines of credit secured by home equity mortgages. The bill confirms that a line of credit instrument may also be used to secure commercial credit agreements. Under the bill, however, the statutory provisions permitting a borrower to limit the indebtedness secured by a line of credit instrument would only be available in consumer transactions. Third, under the existing statute, it is unclear whether the maximum amount that must be disclosed on the front page of the instrument includes advances which are unknown at the time of execution of the original instrument. The bill clarifies that only the maximum principal amount must be disclosed. Fourth, the existing statute requires that the term of the credit agreement be disclosed on the front page of the instrument. The bill clarifies that the maturity date, exclusive of any option to renew or extend the maturity date, must be disclosed. Fifth, under the existing statute, there's some confusion whether certain types of advances have priority as of the date of recording and whether notice of an intervening lien affects the priority of advances. The bill confirms that principal advances will have priority as of the date of recording to the extent that the principal advances do not exceed the maximum principal amount stated in the instrument. The bill clarifies that so-called protective advances will have priority as of the date of recording, whether or not the advances exceed the maximum principal amount stated in the instrument. The bill also clarifies that advances made to complete construction of commercial improvement will have priority as of the date of recording, whether or not such advances exceed the maximum principal amount stated in the instrument, providing that notice of such advances is provided in the instrument. The bill further clarifies that knowledge of an intervening lien will not affect the priority of subsequent advances. And finally, the bill clarifies that actions that do not affect the priority of a line of credit instrument include those actions described in ORS 86.095, subsection 1. The remaining provisions of ORS 86.095, such as the disclosure required by subsection 3, will not apply to line of credit instruments. I'd be happy to answer any questions any member of the committee might have.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Burns.
Would you go over that again in terms of time considerations? You spoke of principal advances. Could you give an example on that?
Certainly. Were you talking about principal advances during construction or just generally?
Generally. Let's say I go borrow a line of equity, borrow money in a line of equity on my house. So they give me, let's say I can go up to $20,000. They gave me $10,000 today, and then later on I borrow other amounts for education or whatever it may be, what would be the priority of these subsequent borrowings then?
Well, both under the existing statute, and the bill doesn't change the thrust of the statute, the future borrowings that you would make under that $20,000 cap would relate back and have priority to the date of recording of the mortgage. That's the overall thrust of the line of credit mortgage statute, and we're not proposing to change that. We're just trying to clarify how it works and clarify some of the terminology.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nadeau.
Under this bill, then, if the if, say, it was a $20,000 line of credit that were made subsequent to that, if it said in there that advances, additional advances could be made, say then subsequently it was decided they would increase that line of credit to $30,000, would those all relate back to the filing of the lien?
The relation back would only be to the original $20,000, and then if the mortgage were amended to increase the maximum principal amount to $30,000, then the additional amount between $20,000 and $30,000 would relate back to the time of the recording of the amendment.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Further questions? Steve, in your item 4 here, where you're talking about advances to pay taxes and insurance premiums will have priority as of the date of the recording of the line of instrument. Priority as to what?
Priority as to subsequent liens, for example, and we think that is the present law. We're just trying to clarify what the law we think already says. For example, if a lender, if a borrower does not pay their taxes when they're due, lenders typically in their loan agreements have the ability to, and under common law, have the right to make those advances to protect themselves. And so they would pay the bill, they would pay the tax bill. That obligation to repay the amount the lender advanced to pay the tax bill would be added to the debt owed by the borrower, and that obligation as well as the principal amount of the loan would relate back to the time of recording. So if a second mortgage had been put on, that first mortgage lender would not be harmed by the fact that they advanced money to pay the borrower's taxes.
And this would be true irrespective of what the date of the advance to pay the taxes was?
That's correct. It would have priority just like the main part of the loan from the date of recording. And again, we think that the case law on protective advances makes it pretty clear that lenders can, for fire insurance premiums or for taxes, if they are in a position where they need to make that advance, that amount is added to the debt under most typical loan agreements, and that amount is also has priority just like the principal part of the loan.
Okay, does the bill contain language to show the court how or that the lender made the advances to protect their interest?
The bill doesn't define what I believe in great detail what protective advances are, but it does say that it says interest, lawful charges, and advances made at any time pursuant to the credit agreement for the reasonable protection of the real property, including but not limited to advances to pay real property taxes, hazard insurance premiums, maintenance charges imposed under declaration or restrictive covenant, and reasonable attorney fees, whether or not such interest, lawful charges, or advances shall exceed the maximum principal amount stated in the line of credit, then we'll relate back. So that's the test.
Okay. Further questions by committee members? Okay, thank you, Steve. Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 382? Okay, discussion by committee members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nadeau.
I think this is a very good bill. I've been in this kind of work before, and often these are tangled webs and this will help clear up, I think, some of the problems.
Further comments?
I think it's a good bill, but I get a feeling we're going to have to do some adjustments in the next session. I can see some problems coming down the horizon. But for the time being, I think it's something we probably need.
Okay, Representative Nadeau, would you care to move the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill A engrossed, 382 be passed to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay, the motion is to send Senate Bill 382A to the floor with do-pass recommendation. Further discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Barnes.
Aye.
Nato.
Aye.
Oakley.
Aye.
Stein.
Aye.
Walden. Reichen.
Aye.
Mr. Chair.
Aye. Motion passes. Representative Nato, would you like to carry the bill?
I'd be happy to. Thank you.
Okay, we'll now open a public hearing. No, we'll now open a work session on Senate Bill 429. And, Harry, you can bring us up to date on 429, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 429A was originally heard in Subcommittee Number 1. This bill, essentially, it specifies the liability of persons providing advice or services in connection with the offer, sale, or purchase of securities. And I believe there's testimony at the original hearing from an Oregon State Bar Task Force on this and the Oregon Department of Insurance and Finance, who testified.
Which subcommittee?
Subcommittee 1.
Okay. Representative Barnes, do you have any further comment?
Well, I have a note. We held a public hearing on this back in the 16th of April, Mr. Chair, and I have a note here that Mr. Bronner says it has problems. I wonder if he's prepared to come up and speak to us a little bit about this.
Mr. Bronner, would you please help us out a little bit, please?
Yeah, 429.
Yeah, I'll come back and cover this.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. The bill as it is before you is a bill that deserves to be passed, and our problems have been resolved.
Further comments?
Mr. Chair, are you ready for a motion?
I was just getting some information about the bill. I haven't had time to digest, but I'm not sure I'm ready to vote on it.
Anyone that can help the rumination process?
What kind of, who's objecting and why?
Well, I haven't had given some information.
Would you like some time to think about it a little bit, Representative?
If possible, can we put it to the bottom of the
remove
list
back
today?
Okay,
thank
we'll
you, Mr. Chair.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 429. We've got a 10 o'clock public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 634. Members, I have a letter from Senator Yee in the file here, which I just got this morning, saying that she supports Senate Bill 634, and as you can see, she's one of the primary sponsors.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barnes.
As you know, 634 is similar to House Bill 2211 that we passed out some time ago from the House. Has our committee, committee administrator have a chance to compare these two to see where the differences are, or if there are any differences?
Oh, no. This is the name driver exclusion.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Stein.
Yeah, I have a memo that maybe is coming now from Lana Butterfield explaining this.
Okay, Lana Butterfield?
If you could just sort of run it by
could you quick. Tell us about the amendment that was made or the change that was made in the Senate?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would be happy to do that. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. Excuse me, I'm with the Oregon Professional Insurance Agents. I did distribute a memo that traces the history of Senate Bill 634. The only difference between these two is in Section 11. Apparently, and I'm not clear if it was during the special session or during the last session, some reference to a code change was missed. And so the insurance division requested that premium audits be applied to all workers' comp carriers. This includes SAFE. SAFE has apparently been doing this all along and did not oppose the amendments. It is a very minor technical change. That is the only difference between the two bills.
So, Mr. Chair, the insurance agency then is insurance industry is supportive of this?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we are. Mr. Chair, Representative Barnes.
It really doesn't seem to be a germane amendment. I don't know that we would have considered that on this side. But
Mr. Chair.
Now. Representative NATO.
Lana, does this bill have anything, was it a gut and stuff completely, or are there other things from that are in 634 that were not in our bill?
The two bills started simultaneously. 634 dealt only with the name driver issue.
Okay.
House Bill 2211 was an omnibus division bill.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative.
Well, are you ready for a motion?
Representative Kennemer would like to address us briefly on either the content or the genesis of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that very much. For the record, State Senator Bill Kennemer, and appreciate the hearing very much. During the interim, name driver exclusion was an issue that was of considerable concern. I convened a substantial number of meetings, spent a lot of time, a small portion of my folder on it, and you know how these things evolve. I think Lana has explained basically what occurred there in the Senate side, and would encourage passage and be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Okay, ready for a motion now? Representative Stein?
Yes, I would move Senate Bill 634 as amended to the floor with the UTAS recommendation.
Okay, the motion is to send Senate Bill 634 and Gross to the floor with UTAS recommendation. Further discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Barnes?
Aye.
NATO?
Aye.
Oakley?
Aye.
Stein?
Aye.
Walden? Reichen?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Who carried this last time?
I think I did, Mr. Chair.
I think
Chair.
Carrie did.
Yeah. Would you like me to carry it again? Need the experience.
Good second time.
Yeah. This time you can just say good bill should pass.
Okay, we will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 863. Is Mr. Swenson here? His representative, Mr. Nicola.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mr. Swenson is no longer with us. Effective this morning, I am the acting administrator of the insurance division.
For sure. Well, where did Mr. Swenson go?
Mr. Swenson resigned and took a position with a company in Maryland.
Well, we're certainly going to miss him. I think I can speak for all of the committee members that we've very much appreciated him. We trust we're in good hands, and I guess I'm confident that we are.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Charles Nikoloff. I am the acting administrator of the insurance division. With me is Elaine Day, deputy administrator. The Department of Insurance and Finance is basically a dedicated fund agency. The insurance division's primary source of revenue are agents' license examination fees, agents' license original and renewal fees, certificates of authority issued to insurance companies, examination costs that are recouped from direct billing, workers' compensation premium assessments, and insurance company premium assessments. Senate Bill 863 amends insurer premium.
To work out the amendments to keep the costs down. They were actively involved in developing the amendments of the bill.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 874. We'll return to that as time permits. Representative Barnes, I think you did raise a good point on Senate Bill 874 about the individuals working on their own properties. Yeah. Okay, we'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 3582, and we have Representative Repine and Representative Parkinson, I believe, and Representative Johnson.
Chairman, we dragged up another party.
Netta, would you please call Representative Parkinson's office and let them know that we are hearing House Bill 3582 now. Representative Repine.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the records, I'm State Representative Bob Repine, District 49 representative. I just wanted to kind of do a little lead-in on House Bill 3582, and there'll be other people who will be able to speak more to the merits of the bill. But this bill deals with an issue that happened, unfortunately, in my district, had to do with a provider of medical programs called Greater Oregon Health Services, who was under kind of a watch of the Department of Insurance Finance and was deemed as insolvent. And then through the course of that time that the department was involved and the healthcare provider was having their problems, there was a lot of other small providers, the pharmacy, doctors, chiropractors, who had money on the table and have been left somewhat holding the bag based on what the outcome of the liquidation might be. One of the reasons is that they're, for the most part, this is one of those rare occasions where this company did not have written contracts with most of the providers, where the law specifically now says that written contracts are to be in place, and therefore you can declare the potential risk if there's an insolvency, then it's the buyer beware approach. And in this particular case, we don't have that for the most part. These are people who have had handshake agreements with this particular organization. I've talked to a lot of the people here in the last couple of days dealing with this bill, and some of the members as of even today. And there are some concerns and reluctancies as how it would go about dealing with this. I think as you hear some of the testimony from the Department of Insurance Finance and some other of the people involved with this, there are some compromises that can be made so we aren't setting a precedent, so we won't look like the general fund is the cash cow, that we can help protect at least the cost aspects of the losses that are on the table and get through this one without having to set any precedents where anybody else would be able to use this as an opportunity to make good on losses. I think when the director from Department of Insurance Finance will be able to speak to those suggestions that would be presented to this committee for consideration. Again, it's an unfortunate thing. It's not, again, a local issue. It's only local from the nature that Joseph Meade, or Greater Oregon Health, happened to be located in Grants Pass. But I can tell you from the provider base, it's everything from Ashland to Astoria. And there's a lot of people that are on the hook, and in many cases, it's small business. I know there's over 300 pharmacy in the state of Oregon that have some investment in the demise of this particular business. And so I would suspect from both the dentist and chiros and anybody else, there's money on the table that people put up in good faith for services and would like to see somehow to at least recover their costs.
What was that number again, Bob?
Pardon me?
How many?
309 in-state and 69 pharmacy supply houses out of state. And that's, like I said, everything from Astoria to Ashland.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eldon Johnson, District 51. I got started in this issue as a facilitator in getting the parties together and trying to figure out really what the problem was, whether there was any reason to try to deal with this issue or not. And the conclusion I came to after discussions with the parties was that there's good legitimate reason to believe that, in fact, the losses would not have been as great had the state liquidated the facility at the time they took it over, and that we, as the state, as a entity, has a responsibility to deal with this issue, given that they made what turned out to be a bad decision in not liquidating at the time the property was taken over. It is really unfortunate. It's a difficult thing to see, but I think this is one of those one-time issues that we should look at and should step up to the table to accept some responsibility for the actions of the state. One of the things about that will come up subsequently will be the issue of what is the extent of the liability, and I think the agency can fill you in on that. And it ranges, as I'm told, from nothing to a couple of $1 million, and they may have an update that may be different, but when this started, that was a range of risk that was outstanding. And the proposed method of dealing with it would be to reserve money in the e-board against a resolution of the accounts of the organization. Apparently the books are not that good a shape. They're being built back together to understand really exactly what's happening, get a current status so that only the legitimate bills that are due get paid. And as a result, the payments would not be made or authorized until that had been done. That's estimated like 6 months. I think the bill allows for 6 months for that to occur. So that's sort of the progression of the process. There's a lot of work that needs to be done by the state in their role as the agency in dealing with this yet, but to get the enabling legislation to deal with the problem is what we're here to ask. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. I guess I'm struggling a little here. The the bankruptcies happen in every type of business, and that's a risk that you take, but are you saying then that the Department of Insurance and Finance is somehow, I think we've jumped through a few assumptions here, and I don't know the background of this. Did they come in and act inappropriately, or what is the basis? Why should the state pay
story,
for this?
Okay, the story I got, and the agency can confirm or adjust to this, but the story I got from them and parties was that the state stepped in as their role as a regulator, took over the functions and operations of that company, and proceeded to lose $50,000 a week in their efforts to try to liquidate or sell the book of business. Had they closed that operation and liquidated it, there would have been substantially more money in resources available for the people who had provided services to get paid. The state made a conscious decision to continue to operate, and to the detriment of the people who would have expected to be payment for their services.
Follow-up question. So were some of these claims incurred while the state was administering?
Yes. In fact, that's the largest part of the problem.
Oh, I see.
See, it wasn't like before the fact. I don't think you could. We'd be here if, in fact, they led people to believe that you'll get paid. That's what I've thought. I've saw was that they led people to believe that they, if you just play along, we'll help you get paid well. The resources were being dissipated at the same time, to the extent that when they finally close it, the amount of exposure yet unknown is in the range I described. And that's how it played out. I understand where you're coming from with that. I wouldn't be here as a party to this if, in fact, it was before the closure of the, when they took over the business.
Mr. Chair, a quick question. Eldon, I've received quite a bit of communications from drugstores and other small providers. Do you know if there are any citizens that are due reimbursement or would be due reimbursement under this bill? Otherwise, they paid the bill with the expectation of getting reimbursed from the Greater Oregon Health Insurance Company.
I think I'm not the right person for the right person.
Representative Fred Parkinson, District 28. There will probably be other people yet to testify, is that correct?
Yes, I
have. I can give you the specifics. But no, these people are subscribers, and like with pharmacy services, they simply pay a deductible and have no further obligation. And I'd like to just give my comments in favor of the bill, and you'll have the other people that can give you the specifics later. But in a nutshell, we were told, I'm a pharmacy provider in real life, so I'm sure I must have a conflict of interest on this bill, so I'll declare that at this time. But we were told like a month before or something that we probably had a contractual obligation, maybe 2 or 3 months before, I don't know, maybe in January, maybe December, I can't remember. But anyway, we had a contractual obligation to fill these, but it seemed like everything was going okay because the state, you know, had taken them over. And probably legally we couldn't even refuse. But after that point, we were reassured almost on a day-by-day basis that the bills would be paid. So your pharmacies around continued to fill the prescriptions. And then we didn't know that there'd been a change until, I guess, the day it happened. So that you have a state agency that was not being truthful and were, I think, have some responsibility.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, if the receiver, in this case the state was acting as receiver, if the receiver had been a non-public entity, say there was a potential bankruptcy, I think this is analogous, and a receiver was appointed who was a private company of some sort, and that private company didn't act appropriately, didn't act with due diligence or whatever, which is what you're essentially saying here, what would the remedy be?
Well,
you're asking the state to back it up. I'm asking if this is exactly the same, but it wasn't the state, who would back that up? Or would you have to go to court to sue the receiver?
I think you'd probably, Representative Stein, my suspicion is that the only remedy would be through court, and that would be the injured party. That would be the provider on a one-to-one basis, I would suspect, possibly. They could
or
go into a class action suit. Some of these people have a lot of money on the table. Some of these people have a little money on the table. So then all of a sudden you start dividing them amongst themselves, saying, gee, do I want to enter into a class action suit to recover $17.39, or do I want to enter into one because I happen to be $70,000 on the table? So the role that we're trying to do is just trying to, what this bill is trying to do is, since there was not, in many cases, any written contracts, any kind of obligation that says, here are the roles and the obligations you as a provider will participate with us, that means that if we happen to be insolvent or we happen to have financial problems, you understand the risk. That's for the most part, we're not written contracts. That's what makes this one somewhat unique. I mean, that's an assumption that there's risk, that people knew what the risks are. And again, because of what Representative Parkinson just said, in my case, where my pharmacy people who were contacting the department also trying to find out the status of the accounts and the status of Greater Oregon Health's future, were led to believe that things were going well, the business would be as usual, and you could count on that it wasn't going to be any different. And that didn't happen. There was a whole other bunch of negotiations. There was an offer being, this package was being kept in place to enhance the saleability to QuaMet for some consideration, and that was one of the reasons they were wanting to make it look like it was a viable program, so QuaMet would offer as much money as possible to buy that book of business. that came down at the end of the line, Quamit backed out. And so now we have no money on the table for a, from a bona fide offer. It was, you know, just kind of a good faith offer and drew a lot of people into there. And then it's like saying to the providers, it didn't happen, so gee, we're sorry. And so what we're trying to do is at least get to the point where at least the people who provided the services and products would at least, if nothing else, recover a portion of their costs for their drugs, their aspirins, whatever it might have been, because they put their money out now in a situation where they felt being that they were being drawn into a situation where this would be resolved, and in fact it wasn't resolved. It actually came to its termination sometime later.
Excuse me, I need to be excused. I'm expected in another committee.
Thank you, Representative Jones.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
You indicate that they should at least be able to get a portion. The way this is, my understanding though here is you're saying they should get 100% reimbursement.
Yeah, and Representative Stein, because you know your comments that we had earlier this morning, I took that to heart and I said, well, you know, you made a valid point. Is it fair that the state of Oregon pay for Blue Sky? And I think you're going to find some options and some suggestions that say possibly establishing what the cost of the product or the service is reasonable and something that would give some relief for not all, you know, a percentage of 5%, 10% of expenses. But even that is better than what's on the table today, because what's on the table today is an uncertainty. By the time you go through the receivership and get done paying everybody else, who knows what's going to be left. And for some cases, small business people like, you know, Mr. Parkinson over here, that's a lot of money. And that's their money out of their pocket. And if they could at least, if nothing else, recover their costs, they probably would sleep better at night knowing they had that opportunity. And I think the department will even testify that there's a potential with that as a compromise, there might be enough cash resources from the time the liquidation is terminated that we may not be investing in. But at least there's some guarantee. What I was to suspect is a pretty immense list of people who participated, that they have some certainty of knowing what they're going to get. And I think that's reasonable.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Stein.
Just one final thing. I think this is misdrafted here. Lines 24 and 25 talks about money provided for legal services and civil matters to adult offenders.
Yeah, you know, we've always questioned that, and I don't know how it came in there.
This sounds like some boilerplate here.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. It's something that... we have some amendments, -1 amendments that probably will eliminate that section. Anyhow, again, if the committee will listen to the people who will be testifying, only not only as providers but also the agency, I think you'll find that there's been some kind of an agreement of if we were to step up and be responsible to do this, how we could do this so the state doesn't look like the cash cow, and we've protected the interest of those providers and made the best effort that we could on behalf of them.
Mr. Chair?
NATO.
I have a couple comments, and I think they would speak to the amount, if any, that the state should, you know, come to the table for. The first policy issue that I can see is analogous to what Representative Stein was saying. In the case of a receiver in a bankruptcy, I would imagine the receiver would have insurance, and that in this case, I would say, if there was inappropriate action on the state's part, then I think the state should back it up completely, and you know that would be something I would be interested in knowing. But the second issue would be whether, if the state as the receiver, just the fact that the state of Oregon, in and of itself, led people to believe that they would be paid, that's a separate policy issue, and I think, you know, that might be one that would speak to partial recovery if people were relying on the fact that the state of Oregon would back up the obligation. So.
You know, just to put a final spin on it from my standpoint, what makes this case more difficult is the fact that it was in transition. It was between the past administrator of the department and the new administrator, and, you know, there was in that handoff, of which actually, from what I understand, the governor actually signed the insolvency papers. So, I mean, it's not like it's been in one person's pocket all this time, and that's what has caused this, I think, to even get more out of hand, because there was a changing of guard in the department, and there was some possible breakdown of communications on that part of it too. Not trying to blame you, I'm just saying I think that transition did not help the situation any.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to leave. I have other obligations. There are experts here that can tell you about it. I'm sure
Mr.
they must
Chair,
be signed up.
Before Fred leaves, Representative Parkinson, your contract with this insurance company. Did it specify so many dollars for certain types of medicine and prescriptions that you filled?
No, my agreements are with a firm called Pharmaceutical Services Group, PSG, and they contracted with Greater Oregon.
But the point of it is, if you filled a given prescription for a certain type of medicine, you were, you know, allowed to charge X amount of dollars for that.
Yes, we had an agreement on what we could charge, yes. And but our relationship was with PSG, and they service plans for a number of different companies.
I see. Thank you.
They are here to testify.
Mr. Chairman, I asked Mr. Powell up to maybe kind of help set the stage in regards to some of the concerns that the group that he represents has. He'll be brief, he promised me.
Okay, we have another some additional business to conduct. So please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Earlier he said he had drugged me up here. There were no drugs administered in that transaction, I assure you. Let me simply start off by saying that I told Representative Repine, I think, the same thing that some of you did, and that is you got to watch out for a precedence here. And from the angle of Blue Cross Blue Shield, if it could be determined who did not have a contractual arrangement in this case, then I think that something maybe could be done to make whole some of those who lost in that situation, because we did go through this last session. At the end of the session, the department's going to be able to explain that to you, where an agreement was reached that health service contractors should have contracts with providers. And I think, for the most part, they do now, so that the consumer is held harmless, so that they are not injured in these cases. And I might close with just one other comment, and that is the insurance division, when they have end up in this situation, are in a very, very difficult situation. They were trying to hold this together for sale. If they told any of the parties that they better run, then there'd be a run on the bank. It's very similar to a financial institution when you're trying to hold it together, hoping that there's a sale that will take it in and keep everything going. And that is the way it looked, and that fell through. So I think the division attempted to act in good faith, given that set of circumstances. When that fell through, the administrator at that time, whose last day was Friday, appealed to Blue Cross Blue Shield to come in and take over everything on May 1st, and they did that. So as of May 1st, that was taken care of, and they're talking about that period in the interim. So, and we, just one little advertisement, we didn't do that for our health and welfare. That was not something that we did because we thought it would be financially advantageous. We did it because we thought it would help the state and the people involved.
Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3582. Representative Reichen requests unanimous consent to cast her vote on Senate Bill 666.
And I would do.
How do you vote on any
vote.
Objection? So ordered.
I vote aye, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Reichen votes aye. Representative Nato requests unanimous consent to vote on Senate Bill 666. Any objection? So ordered. How do you vote, Representative Nato?
No.
Representative Nato votes no. Representative Walden, you want to vote on these other bills?
That's fine.
Okay, Representative Walden requests unanimous consent to cast his vote on Senate Bill 634. Any objection? So ordered. Representative Walden, how do you vote on
Senate
Bill 634? Representative Walden votes aye. Representative Walden requests unanimous consent to cast his vote on Senate Bill 382 and Senate Bill 863. Any objection? So ordered. How do you vote on Senate Bill 382, Representative Walden?
Aye.
And how do you vote on Senate Bill 863?
Aye.
So ordered. Representative Oakley is not here. Is anyone else that missed any votes that you want to cast votes on? If not, we're adjourned.